You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Bob Ferret. Coming up, fears of a recession loom as the novel coronavirus outbreak continues. We'll talk to a policy analyst about how Wisconsin could weather the possible economic downturn. First, Brandon Taylor was a biomedical researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison before leaving the field to become a writer and editor. His debut novel, Real Life, follows Wallace, a young black and queer man from the South trying to get his footing as a graduate student in a mostly white Midwest college town. Throughout the book, the protagonist navigates his relationships with colleagues, friends, and a love interest, while also feeling increasingly isolated. The novel has been getting glowing reviews, with O, the Oprah magazine, calling it a blistering coming-of-age story. Brandon Taylor talked with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about his work.
Your main character, Wallace, is black, gay, and from the South. And the feeling of being on the outside looking in as a grad student in Madison is really palpable. How much of that is from your own experiences?
Much of it, in fact. I was a graduate student here from about 2013 to 2017, and, you know, it was a difficult time. I mean, it was also a great time. It was really beautiful. The city, I mean, Madison's a great place to be a young person and to kind of figure that out. But graduate school itself is like a fairly precarious time. So I spent a lot of time feeling kind of lonely and on the edge of things.
And my sense of Wallace is that he has a really deep emotional well, but he's really closed that off for most of his life. And when he starts allowing himself to have some feelings, a lot of others come rushing to the surface. Is that how he felt to you?
Yeah, I mean, I in writing Wallace, I was interested in trying to explore a character who had a great deal of feeling and who was really sensitive and alert to the world, but who, for various reasons of self-preservation, had kind of closed that off. And I wanted to explore what happens when that dam begins to break and to sort of chart not only the feelings of the moment, but like that long lifetime history of all the buried stuff that he just didn't let himself feel just to survive it, you know. And so that certainly was a part of the motivating energy of the novel for me as I was writing it.
It seems like the past traumas that Wallace deals with give him feelings of worthlessness and that he's not as lovable as many of his peers, and many of his peers being white people. I think that's something that so many of us can relate to.
Yeah, I think that the culture teaches us all things about ourselves and ways we internalize narratives about worthiness. And I think we all do, in fact, go around feeling like other people have it better. Other people their life is so easy. And it's because we only have like the surface level of like what's going on in their lives. And we don't know that the people that we love most often, in fact, also feel these feelings of unworthiness. And I think part of that is just because, you know, we live in a world of surfaces and projections, and we live in a world where we're always trying to put forward our best image. But, you know, when you're sort of at home alone, you're really thinking about all the mess of your life. And I think the novel kind of charts what happens in a friend group when we don't really know people as well as we think we do.
And those relationships are always inherently messy. And then you put on the layer of, you know, flirting and relationships and, you know, is this person really my friend? Is this person really interested in me romantically or not? It gets really complicated.
Yeah. I mean, but that as a writer is one of my most, that's one of the things I'm most interested in, is like the inherent messiness of human connection and human relation. And you know, like when you're a grad student, you're trying to figure out so many things about your life and like love lives and like dating within programs. It's always such a fraught space. And so that was just like a really rich place for me as a storyteller. I just had a lot of fun teasing out, you know, all of the various conflicting agendas and does he like me? Does he not like me? Are these people my friends? Are they not my friends? I just find that just like such a rich space as a writer.
Wallace is a graduate student, as we've been talking about. His work is in biochemistry, and he's studying and running experiments on a particular type of worm. He and others in the book comment on how they are not suited to life in the real world. And I have to say, even going back to my own graduate school experiences, it is such a pressure cooker and social bubble that you are in with these people, especially I was in the humanities, but in a lab environment, you are around these people for many hours a day. They are often also your social group. I mean, it is a really kind of unnatural social environment. And I actually couldn't help but think that Wallace and his colleagues, his friends, weren't that far removed from these worms that he was raising in this very rarefied environment.
Oh, that's kind of an amazing comparison. I hadn't quite thought about that. But I mean, certainly, I think that there is something about academia, because it is kind of a petri dish in a way, right?
Like
it's this isolated social setting where the media is like very closely regulated. The conditions are very closely regulated because you're trying to turn young minds into like brilliant researchers in a field, you know? I kind of love that comparison because they are like little organisms under close observation.
Well, and there's also this weird inherent competitiveness when you are trying to be the top in your field or one of the best or at least recognized, and there are so few positions that you might actually be able to get into. So while they are the people closest to you, they are also your biggest competition.
Yeah, and I think that also just extends to the nature of like mentorship as well, because in essence, their mentors are training them to replace them at some point, but often the mentors don't actually want to retire. And so it's like this very weird environment where it's like very collegial and very supportive, but also they are such scarce resources that like, if you stop to think about the material reality of it, it's like, oh, these people who are my dearest friends, they also are going to want jobs someday, and those are the same jobs that I want. And so I have to see them as like future competitors, mm-hmm. but also colleagues, but also peers, but also my dear friends. Like it's incredibly messy and really, really fraught.
We're talking with Brandon Taylor right now about his debut novel called Real Life, based on his own experiences as a graduate student here in Wisconsin. And there were aspects of your novel, Brandon, that reminded me of another recent debut novel by another African-American author. It's called Everywhere You Don't Belong by Gabriel Bump. And especially the aspect of never feeling quite at home, quite like you belong, no matter where you are or who you are with. I felt that in both of the books. In your experience, is that a challenge for many African-Americans, regardless of their sexual orientation?
I really love Gabriel Bump. We did an event together recently. He's just, he's so talented. You know, I do think that for many people of color, and speaking as an African-American myself, I do think that that is something that when I talk to my other black friends, that's something that comes up a lot. We talk a lot about feeling kind of both wanted in these spaces and also like very unwanted. And it's just like, it's incredibly difficult. It's a really challenging thing to navigate, you know, even progressive spaces as a person of color, because often these progressive spaces, as accepting and, you know, progressive and liberal as they are, they also sit upon a bedrock of, you know, like white fragility and like white supremacy. And so like it's difficult to navigate that, even when people have such good intentions. Sometimes those intentions come out in ways that are actually harmful and damaging. And with this book, I was really determined to write that nuanced reality, because it's not that people are bad or evil. It's just that it's hard to be a person in the world, mm-hmm. you know, like it's hard to make your intentions felt and known. And even when you do your best, sometimes it's not enough. And sometimes it does do harm. And I think that the novel kind of articulates that. Like it's trying to get at the fact that no one is perfect, no one is 100% right, and that when you live in a society, you participate in both doing harm and you are harmed by it.
while you did say that you're drawing in large part on your own experiences at school here in Madison, did writing through Wallace's eyes bring you any new insights into those experiences, kind of, you know, bringing the circle around?
I think so. You know, when I was writing the novel, I was revisiting some really quite negative experiences. And through writing, I came to understand kind of the other side, not to sort of pardon some of the things that were done to me or to excuse them, but I think I did come to a place of deeper understanding and empathy for those people. And I came to understand, you know, sort of how a person could think that what they were doing was right. So, I think the novel did bring me, I don't say closure, but it did bring me some understanding. And that understanding, I think, was really helpful in understanding the place. And I think also in writing it, I came to understand that I actually really love Madison. It was an incredibly rich time in my life when I learned how to be an adult and how to be in the world. And it's a time that I wouldn't take back for anything. Like, I would never want to sort of erase it, even though some of my experiences were negative.
What kind of response have you gotten to Real Life so far?
I had really modest expectations for this novel because it's a very quiet novel about some scientists in Madison on a weekend. And I thought maybe some people would read it. But the response has been so generous and so moving. So many former scientists have read it and reached out to me and said that it felt so much like their own experiences. And so many of my dear friends in Madison who were part of my science cohort have read the novel and have just been so loving and full of support and kindness. And so it's been more than I could ever have imagined. It's just been so incredible.
And Brandon, what's next for you?
I'm finishing up edits on a short story collection that I think should be coming out next summer.
Well, we will look forward to that and to talking with you about it. Brandon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was writer Brandon Taylor. He talked with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about his debut novel, Real Life. Coming up, we'll talk to a policy analyst about what the Wisconsin government learned from 2008's Great Recession and what it could mean as the state faces a possible economic downturn amid the novel coronavirus outbreak. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson. Coming up, as the coronavirus outbreak continues, many state and local governments have issued guidelines for residents to stay at home and practice social distancing. We'll talk to an epidemiologist about how effective these measures are and how much longer they might need to be in place. Now, in 2008, the United States faced one of the most significant economic downturns since the Great Depression and could soon face another big economic hit. At the height of the aptly named Great Recession, unemployment topped out at 10% in the United States, and economies around the world took years to recover. Fast forward to today, we don't have subprime mortgages fueling an economic downturn. Instead, mass layoffs and chilled consumer spending due to the spread of the novel coronavirus have stoked fears of another recession. A new report takes a look at what lessons Wisconsin learned from the Great Recession and how the state might weather a COVID-19-related downturn. Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, John. Appreciate being here.
Before we get started, can you quickly give us an overview of how the factors that led to the Great Recession differ from what we might be seeing now?
Sure. I mean, they certainly have a similar amount of severity. The difference in the case of the Great Recession, there you had a financial crisis that was brought on by something really fundamentally wrong with the country, you know, certain types of toxic debt that, you know, sort of reverberated through the financial system. You know, here we had an economy that at least to all appearances was sound when this crisis struck, and really the economic effects are downstream of public health decisions that people have made at the local, state, and federal level to try to minimize the harm to people's health. And so one of the challenges is that the kinds of typical things that the government would do to spur demand in the midst of a recession, like, you know, getting money into people's pockets, cutting taxes, things like that, you can get that to people, but they can't necessarily go out and spend it with restaurants that are hurting, with bars that are hurting, with hotels that are hurting, because those businesses have been shut down.
Well, let's go back to 2008. How was Wisconsin set for the downturn before the Great Recession? What kind of shape were we in going into that?
That's a nice framing question, John. In the run-up to the Great Recession, Wisconsin was arguably one of the least prepared states in the country, particularly when you looked at our short-term reserves. So whether you were looking at our general fund, which that is the main set of accounts for the state of Wisconsin that pays for health care for the needy, school aids, universities, prisons, things like that, we had very little in the way of cash reserves in the general fund. We're among the worst states in the country, less than 1% of annual spending. When you looked at our unemployment fund, that was also unprepared for even a moderate recession, let alone the really serious recession that we saw in 2008 and 2009. And so the good news is that today, and we can talk about it, we are at least better positioned.
Okay, so we're a few weeks into what seems to be a slowing economy. That may be an optimistic view of it. At what point will we know if we've hit an actual recession here in Wisconsin?
I mean, you know, the traditional definition of a recession is the economy contracting for two calendar quarters. You know, I mean, I think we can sort of set aside the technical definition of it and just look at, we have seen people go on to the unemployment system making initial claims in numbers that we have never seen in data in Wisconsin going back to the 1980s and going back to the national level decades further than that. So we know that we are seeing, at least in the speed of it, an economic shock that is truly unusual and truly serious.
With that in mind, how is Wisconsin situated to weather an economic downturn due to this coronavirus outbreak?
Sure. So, I mean, the good news is we're in much better shape than we were in 2007. I mean, the unemployment insurance fund, you know, had roughly $2 billion in it in 2019. That is, depending on how you measure it, 2.5 or 3 times more than we had in 2007. So that's the good news. And the same with the general fund. The general fund has, you know, roughly 10% of spending nearly, which is, again, an order of magnitude bigger than in 2007. That's the good news. The bad news is we're still, you know, no better probably than the average state. Our unemployment fund on one key measure of solvency ranks maybe 30th nationally. We're also sort of in the middle of the pack for our general fund. So although we're much better shape than we were in the past, we're still really in the middle of the pack for other states. And this is something that is going to wallop every state, you know, really hard. So I don't want to leave listeners with the impression that there won't be a lot of pain and difficult choices, because there will be.
Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's with us to talk about the health of the state's economy and how it could weather a potential coronavirus-related recession. What economic factors, Jason, could hit Wisconsin's coffers particularly hard if the outbreak continues on its current trajectory? You mentioned unemployment. What else would be a problem?
You know, local government relies a lot on the property tax, which is much more stable. State government, really all the major taxes for state government, will take a hit here. You know, income tax, as you see people laid off of their jobs, they're not going to have income taxes withheld from their paychecks. So that'll take a hit. You look at restaurants, bars, hotels, so many of the businesses that were forced to shutter collect sales taxes, whereas some of the other things like grocery stores where we go and buy food, you don't have sales taxes collected on that. So that takes a hit. Corporate taxes, corporate profits are going to be hurt. Those will go down. Gas taxes, people aren't going to drive as much. Those are going to go down. So you're going to really see impacts to state revenues really, you know, across the board.
Senator Tammy Baldwin is going to be on our show tomorrow to talk about the $2 trillion stimulus package passed last week in Washington. What impact could this stimulus have on Wisconsin's economy, and does it go far enough?
I mean, one thing that's really difficult in assessing whether it goes far enough, how hard we'll be hit, is what is the length of this? Again, if you were to say tomorrow that all of this could come off and we could return to normal, the impact is way different than if it lasts for weeks and months, which seems more likely right now. So that's one challenge. That $2 trillion piece of legislation has helped for all kinds of entities in Wisconsin. So it has additional unemployment benefits. It has direct payout to individuals and families. It has aid to small businesses. It has aid to state and local governments to the tune of roughly $2.2 billion. So there's a wide variety of things that it does that will provide assistance and help to businesses and individuals that are hurt through really no fault of their own. I think it remains to be seen, though, whether it's enough.
Well, that we'll be watching this and seeing what transpires. Thank you very much, Jason, for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined us today to talk about the fiscal health of Wisconsin as fears mount of a potential coronavirus-related recession. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the novel coronavirus outbreak, notably how effective measures such as social distancing and safer at home have been slowing the spread of the disease. That's all coming up on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson. Coming up tomorrow after 7:30 on the morning show, Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Wisconsin joins host Keely Boltina to discuss the upcoming presidential primary in Wisconsin and the state and federal responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. That's tomorrow morning after 7:30 on the Ideas Network. Now, the United States hit a grim benchmark today. The country has overtaken China in the number of total coronavirus-related deaths, with more than 3,500 fatalities reported. As the number of cases grow, President Trump announced this weekend that he's advising Americans nationwide to continue social distancing practices until at least April 30th. Social distancing is just one guideline being recommended by state and local governments in an effort to slow the spread of the virus. Several states, including Wisconsin, have issued orders for people to stay at home unless there's an urgent need to leave. And people have been advised by public health officials to continue washing their hands with soap and water at least 20 seconds to avoid touching their face and avoid people who may be sick. This is our new normal, and the deadlines originally put in place by state and federal officials keep changing as we learn more about how the virus spreads and how to slow its progression. Our next guest joins us to talk about ongoing efforts, how effective they've been, and when Wisconsin might be able to loosen restrictions. Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist with the Laboratory and the UW-Madison Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. Malia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
As an epidemiologist, you've been following the trajectory of the outbreak for a while now. What have you learned over the last month or so as the novel coronavirus has spread throughout the United States?
Well, I typically study other things besides coronavirus. Usually I study childhood infectious diseases and particularly vaccine-preventable diseases. So this has been a quick education for me in this type of virus. And then I think I and lots of other people have been really surprised to see a lot of the features of this virus as it's rolled out. We're learning a lot about its clinical presentation, its epidemic spread, and the characteristics of how easily it's transmitted from person to person. You know, tons of new information comes out every single day. So it's hard to summarize all of the things that we've been learning.
Well, from your perspective, what have our elected officials done to mitigate this? What are the things we've gotten right so far?
Well, I think here in Wisconsin, it's really good news that we were able to implement social distancing earlier on in the epidemic spread within the state as compared to many other states in the country. And I was particularly happy to see that schools were shut down before things had gotten any further out of control than they already were, and that the governor supported pretty firm and early social distancing policies statewide.
On the other hand, what could or should we have done to slow the spread of the virus?
Well, the main thing that we really need in order to get out of the position we're in, and it's the same thing that would have been really good prevention and earlier control, would be testing. We've been very limited in our ability to model the spread of the disease or even have good figures that show how far the disease has spread already as a result of the fact that testing has been very limited. We've had only enough testing availability to test the sickest people who are presenting in emergency rooms with really acute symptoms. And that has put a lot of limits on data scientists like me, as well as the public health officials who are working extremely hard to protect the health of the public.
We mentioned various efforts from stay-at-home guidelines to social distancing recommendations as ways people can help prevent the transmission of COVID-19. Do we have any sense as to how successful those efforts have been so far?
We don't. And the reason for that is because there is the way this disease works, there's a delay in between when we implement a change like the governor's safer at home order that came out a week ago today and when we can actually see any progress in the data that we get. So what happens is, you know, the people who are going to the hospital today with acute symptoms of COVID-19 were most likely infected before the safer at home order went into place. And we won't get their test results back from the labs for another 4 days or so. And so there's this fairly long gap between when we implement a public health measure like the safer at home order and when we can actually see change in the data. And I think it's really important for the public to understand that we do expect to see it looking as if cases are continuing to increase and things are continuing to get worse for a couple of weeks after that safer at home order. But that doesn't mean that new infections are continuing to go up. We just have to wait for the data to show it.
Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory and the UW-Madison Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. We're talking about our response to the coronavirus pandemic. What we've done right, what we haven't done, what we still need to do. Wisconsin saw one of the earliest confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the country. Outside of early hotspots such as Washington State, Wisconsin seemed to respond relatively assessment of how the outbreak has been handled here in Wisconsin.
We're very lucky to have some terrific medical facilities and public health people who are on the case early and have a fairly well-coordinated response, I think, as states go. That first early case that we saw back on February 5th was reported in the state of Wisconsin, really appears not to have spread extensively. And so there was a long pause before we started to see the epidemic really get rolling in the state. And in fact, I've seen several modeling attempts that just ignore that very first case because it doesn't seem to truly reflect the beginning of the local epidemic here.
There have been a lot of questions about when this will be over and when life will return to normal. What, if anything, do we know about the projected timelines of COVID-19 running its course in the United States?
Yeah, that is the question of the hour for sure. Everyone, including myself, would really like to know when things were going to go back to normal or as normal as we can expect them to be going down the line. And the challenge, as I said before, is we have very limited data. And so there are a lot of smart folks out there who are trying to figure out what does the progression of this epidemic look like and when will it peak and when can we expect the cases to start tapering off. I do think that we will start to see some slowing of confirmed cases early to middle next week because that's 2 weeks after the Safer at Home order. But in terms of the peak hospital use and the peak resource use, there are a variety of different projections out there, and they vary a little bit in terms of when we expect it to peak. I've seen one today that said the end of April. There's another fairly well-read projection that says sometime in mid-May will be the peak for Wisconsin.
We're talking with Malia Jones right now. She's a social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory, and she's with us to talk about how steps individuals and officials are currently taking to slow the spread of COVID-19 are working and what still needs to be done. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your assessment of the steps that you're taking, that your neighbors are taking, your elected officials are taking to slow the spread of novel coronavirus? What do you think we should be doing to take care of the outbreak? And what areas are you disappointed with? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues in just a bit here on Central Time.
Hey everybody, I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas and thanks.
How long experts think we're going to have to follow those guidelines for them to be effective? Our guest is Malia Jones, social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. We would like to hear from you as well. How has social distancing and safer at home impacted your day-to-day life? Do you think those efforts have been helpful? What would you like to see state and local governments do to slow the spread? 800-642-1234. 421234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. While we wait for some phone calls, Malia, as an epidemiologist, your impressions carry some weight here. We've been looking to hear from real experts in this area. There have been a lot of questions about when this is going to be over, when it's going to run its course. We've talked about all of that, and I'm sure our audience is going to have quite a few questions as well. President Trump previously said he wanted to reopen the economy by Easter. He's walked that back some, but this highlights something that many people have talked about, that how optimistic we were that this virus spread would peter out somewhat soon. What would have needed to happen to have reached that benchmark if it was ever possible?
I think in order to have the economy bounce back and have everything reopen by the middle of April, we really would have needed to implement widespread, rapid, freely available testing much earlier on in the outbreak than anyone was even really talking about it. We still have not been able to implement that kind of testing, and that remains the biggest obstacle to our reopening the economy. And so in terms of, you know, what would have needed to happen is we would have needed to overcome some of these regulatory and supply chain issues that are preventing testing from being implemented really widely. And we would have needed to do that back in February.
Well, while we are sort of in limbo when it comes to our daily lives normalizing, we've heard a lot about flattening the curve.
Right. So flattening the curve is this concept that if we get a huge spike in cases all happening at the same time and a substantial number of those people need to be hospitalized, we will quickly run out of resources to take care of those patients.
So it's not about fewer cases, it's about having them not all hit at once.
Well, it's kind of about both. So it's really important that we pump the brakes on the rate of spread. This disease is very contagious and it spreads extremely rapidly, and more so even than influenza, which is the other major infectious disease that we deal with every year in the United States. And so things were just happening much too fast for the scientific community or the policy community to respond well. And so we needed to slow down the spread of the disease and just pump the brakes a little bit, like I said, and not see that huge spike all at one time in terms of the number of cases. But at the same time, slowing it down also.
Have we seen any of this flattening at all on a national level?
We have started to see a little bit of evidence of flattening the curve working in those hotspots that broke out earlier than Wisconsin did. New York and Washington State are both showing some promising effects of social distancing measures. And the other thing I just wanted to add about the flattening the curve, the other major benefit that I think is underrated is it gives us time as scientists to figure out what to do. Right now, we don't have a treatment for this disease. And so the more time we have to figure out how to treat people, the better off those cases, their outcomes will be.
Flattening the curve implies that there's a peak. There have been a number of dates thrown around when we might see a peak of cases in Wisconsin, a number of different models that we've been looking at. Why are there so many different dates being projected?
Yeah, so model is just a fancy word for informed guess. And the reason there are so many different dates being projected is that we don't know when the peak will be. There are a lot of unknowns in the assumptions that go into those mathematical models. And the main one is we don't know how many cases we started with. And that's because we didn't have the testing to figure that out. What we know is just the number of people who were sick enough to be in the ERs, and even that has some time lag. So we're working with a pretty weak signal in terms of what we knew at the outset, and that means there's a lot of uncertainty in what we can predict.
Diane's call from Ellison Bay. Diane, thank you for joining us on Central Time today.
Thank you. My comment is simply, I think we need to be a heck of a lot stricter because I'm seeing an influx of people from Illinois up here all of a sudden. I know it's bad down there, but we simply don't have, we've got a 25-bed hospital and four ventilators in Sturgeon Bay, which is a ways away. That's it. So think about closing the borders.
And what about that idea, closing the borders?
John, are you directing that question to me?
Say about closing the borders.
So I think closing state borders is a fairly extreme policy measure that would be unprecedented in the United States, as far as I know, under most circumstances. You know, that said, this is an unprecedented situation. The world has never, ever faced something like this before. And so a lot of creative minds are being applied to figure out what to do. I think that the point is well taken that we do have to be really strict. What we know about the disease is that we have to reduce the number of close contacts each person has in a typical day by 90% in order to effectively reduce the number of cases that we're getting each day after day. And 90% is a big number. So we really do need people to stick to these social distancing restrictions and stay at home.
There have been questions floating around about the incubation period of COVID-19 and how it fits into the curve. What should people know about how the number of illnesses fits into our broader understanding of the curve?
So the incubation period, one of the things that's come out over the last couple of weeks is that we now know that some people are actively infected and shedding the virus that causes COVID-19, but are never symptomatic. And so this makes it very challenging to control, because people could be feeling just fine and still giving it to other folks. And in addition, you're contagious a few days before you show symptoms, even if you do ultimately end up sick with COVID-19. And so that's been new information over the last few weeks. And that does influence the decision to do blanket social distancing rather than just recommending that sick individuals stay at home.
Maybe airborne. That certainly has to change the equation as well.
You dropped out for a second there. Can you repeat that question?
Sorry, we're having some technical difficulties here, but just in from Washington State news that based on some things they experienced there, it's possible that this virus is now airborne, or that it was. And how does that change the equation that we're looking at?
Well, so this question has been flying around a lot. Is it airborne or is it not airborne? To the best of my knowledge, we still think it's transmitted by droplet transmission, which means that it can be airborne for a short amount of time while it, you know, if you sneeze or cough, some kind of spit or snot flies out of your mouth and goes in a trajectory across the room and lands on something. So it can be airborne for a little bit while it's going through that trajectory, but it doesn't just float freely in the air for hours the way, for example, the measles virus does. There are some clinical situations where it can be aerosolized and be breathed in somewhat more easily. But regardless of, you know, like I said, we are learning things about this virus every day. And regardless of whether we at some point confirm that it's airborne or that it's not airborne, the recommendations for now are the same, which is to avoid close contact with other people and also wash your hands and, stay out of crowded situations.
Thank you very much, Malia, for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Malia, sure thing.
Community and environmental sociology. She joined us today to talk about the ongoing efforts to reduce the impact of the coronavirus outbreak. How much longer social distancing, self-isolation should be in place to help curb the
There are many things to enjoy in Wisconsin in every season of the year. Wisconsin Public Radio is here 365 days a year to serve you with informative, thought-provoking programs. Thank you to WPR members whose support makes it all possible.
If you're a sustaining member, your reliable monthly donations help keep our focus on programming and less on fundraising. If you're not a sustainer yet, visit WPR.org and become one right now. Your secure, ongoing gift of $5 or $10 a month will feel great, and it'll keep Wisconsin Public Radio strong for you and your community.
Stay connected with the WPR app on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. It makes it easy to listen to WPR live and read recent news stories. You can also hear WPR programs on demand. WPR is everywhere.